It's Curtain Call. I'm Charles Sipos. Welcome to today's program. In the first of three segments, I'll be speaking with three folks from 6th Street Playhouse, Matlock Zumsteg, Jeff Cote, and Craig Miller, who are here to talk about the producers June 15th through July 15th at 6th Street Playhouse. In the second segment, I'll be speaking with environmental composer Hugh Livingston, who talks about his work and previews his new show, Sonoma Oaks, Points of View, opening Saturday evening at Sonoma County Museum. In the final segment, I'll be speaking with jazz pianist-composer Michelle Rosewoman, who talks about her musical life and her Friday evening Healdsburg Jazz Festival performance. That's coming up after NPR News, which is next on KRCB.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Obama is accusing Republicans of pushing what he describes as unworkable economic policies, such as Bush-era tax cuts. 5 months before the elections, the president urged the GOP to back his agenda, which he says has helped bolster the private sector and the U.S. economy in general.
Job growth in this recovery has been stronger than in the one following the last recession a decade ago. But the hole we have to fill is much deeper, and the global aftershocks are much greater. And that's why we've got to keep on pressing with actions that further strengthen the economy.
Republican Mitt Romney says the president's comments are proof that he's out of touch. Campaigning in Council Bluffs, Iowa today, the GOP's presumptive presidential nominee told voters the economy is in bigger trouble than President Obama cares to admit.
He said the private sector is doing fine. Is he really that out of touch? I think he's defining what it means to be detached and out of touch with the American people.
Romney also called on the Democrats to pay attention to voters' voices in Wisconsin, where Republican Governor Scott Walker overcame a recall election that was triggered by anger over his move to limit collective bargaining. All eyes are on what's happening in Europe and its never-ending debt crisis, or so it seems. Spain says it's still awaiting results of international audits, which are expected to reveal just how indebted Spanish banks are. As Lauren Frey reports from Madrid, officials there are denying reports that a bailout request could be imminent.
Spain's Deputy Prime Minister Soraya Sáenz de Santamaría says the government is determined to wait for auditors' assessment of how much money it'll take to bolster Spanish banks weighed down by bad real estate debt.
En estos momentos está trabajando el Fondo Monetario
Internacional. We're working with the IMF and independent auditors on the amount our financial system needs for a complete cleanup, she told reporters after a weekly cabinet meeting. Santamaría said those audits would be finished in mid-June. She denied reports a request for European aid could come Saturday and said she was unaware of even any discussion about the issue. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Madrid.
A UN monitoring and human rights team has reached a Syrian village where anti-government activists say government forces massacred about 80 people on Wednesday. NPR's Deborah Amos is there as well. She says she's seen severe damage to buildings, body parts in one house, and evidence that something terrible had happened.
The people who have come to their testimonies to the UN and to talk to the reporters are very nervous. Their faces are covered. They have sunglasses on, no names. They're young. They say that they came from a neighboring village. They say they happened here. It is certainly counter to the government's account, which is that it was done by terrorists.
NPR's Deborah Amos in Syria. This is NPR News.
It's KRCB's California Update. I'm Mark Prell. About as many California voters disapprove of the job Governor Jerry Brown is doing as do approve. Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento that's as bad as his ratings have been since he took office early last year.
The latest field poll shows that 4 in 10 California voters don't like the way Brown is doing his job as governor. That's now nearly equal to those that approve of his performance. Brown's job approval ratings have dropped from 48% early in his term to 43% now. Not surprisingly, 61% of Democrats think he's doing a good job, compared with only 20% of Republicans. Now that Governor Brown has released his latest budget proposal, 43% of voters say they don't have enough confidence in him him to do what is right to solve the budget deficit. But the skies aren't so bright for the legislature either. Only 19% of voters say lawmakers are doing a good job. In addition, more voters would side with the governor on the budget than the legislature. At the state capitol, I'm Amy Quinton.
Democratic Senate leader Daryl Steinberg says Governor Jerry Brown and the California legislature aren't too far apart on a budget deal. The state faces a $16 billion deficit ahead of the next Friday's legislative deadline.
There is agreement, I would say, on, well, what's 14 out of 16, whatever percentage that is, you know, on 90%.
Steinberg says the areas of disagreement include the governor's proposed cuts to welfare, child care, college financial aid, and in-home care. That's why hundreds of care workers and their clients rallied outside the Capitol Thursday, including union leader Rob Robbins.
If you are going to spend five times as much to take people out of their homes and put them in an institution, that is not adding up.
Legislative Republicans are not involved in the negotiations because Democrats don't need their votes to pass a budget. That's the California Update from KRCB Radio. I'm Mark Brell.
Yes, you may recognize that. It's The Producers. Well, it's a show that's being put on at 6th Street Playhouse from June 15th through July 15th. And here to talk about that are three gentlemen from 6th Street Playhouse. It's Artistic Director Craig Miller. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Charles. How are you?
I bet you're the Stage Director, too.
Yes. Yep.
How did I guess? Jeff Cote is with us.
Hi, Charles.
Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks.
And Matlock Zumsteg.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so The Producers, originally a movie?
Yeah, originally a movie, 1968 release, Mel Brooks. It's about show business. It's about two guys who come together, unlikely fellows that come together, find each other, and come up with the biggest showbiz scam ever. And let's produce a flop instead of a hit and take all the money and run to Rio.
That's the scam. Okay, I got it. So what prompts them to do that?
They find a loophole. Don't they, Jeff? Why don't you explain it? You're the character of Leo Bloom, and you come up with the idea. And you're also, what's your job title again?
So, yes, I am a financial consultant. That's with a national financial institution. I work for Charles Schwab, which is a proud contributor to NPR, by the way. So the scam is this. I'm an accountant. Leo Bloom is an accountant who realizes that the IRS isn't much concerned with flops. They're not going to investigate how much money was spent in raising to put on a flop. So they decide that if they raise $2 million rather than just $100,000, they could pretty much walk away with the rest of the money. So the idea is to try to find a script of the worst, most offensive possible play musical they could find. Mm-hmm. Something that is sure to close on page four.
And sell 1,000% of it, right?
Yeah. And sell 1,000% of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and offensive is characterized in that tune that which is maybe the most recognizable in the whole show, mm-hmm. and that is
Springtime for Hitler.
Mm-hmm. In Germany.
Right. In Germany.
Yep.
In Germany.
Name of the play.
So it's actually the one song that translated from the, I mean, the original movie was not a musical. Mm-hmm. This was the one musical number in the show. And then Mel Brooks came back and wrote an entire score around, weaving through the original film story, making some changes.
Is it his music?
It's all his music. Wow. Actually, Matlock and I were just talking. We've both been doing a little bit of research, when Mel Brooks was persuaded to turn this into a Broadway musical, he went to Jerry Herman. Hello Dolly, Mame,
frequent guest on Curtain Call.
And Jerry said, yeah, you know what, I'm going to have to pass on this because I know who the perfect composer for this this new version is, and that's you. And so Mel,
wow, what a story.
He did hire Thomas Meehan, who is, of Annie fame, mm-hmm. and Thomas helped him write the book. But yeah, it's all Mel Brooks' music.
And he ended up beating out Jerry for Tony's, I believe. Mm-hmm. Hello Dolly held the record with 10, and now the producers holds the record with 12.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry, what is he now?
He's enough to pass.
Actually, he knew a lot. He's the one who predicted that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so... I think this was developed off Broadway, as is typical, and then went to Broadway and had its long run.
Yeah, it had its tryout in my hometown of Chicago, Illinois.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah, it opened there, and in its original version, I think it was 3.5 hours long. And the intermission alone for the set changeover for a joke that happens at the top of the second act, the intermission was 35 minutes long. So, yeah, it was 3.5 hours. So, of course,
did you see that?
They just kept cutting. I did not see it. I didn't see it until it landed on Broadway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At which time it was a bit shorter, I bet.
Yes. Yeah. But not much, actually. It's right now our show is running about 2:30. With the intermission.
Really?
So, yeah.
You get your money's worth.
You get your money's worth,
The run is at 6th Street Playhouse. If you want to find out more, you can go to the website 6th Street Playhouse. It's all spelled out except the first character is the Arabic number 6. 6thstreetplayhouse.com. And the run is June 15th through July 15th. I'm speaking with Matlock Sumsteg, Jeff Cote, and Craig Miller, and we're talking about the producers. I understand you have a musical number for us, Jeff.
Yeah, if you'd like. We could do a short scene leading into a musical number, and if you got about 5-6 minutes for us.
Yeah, okay. Let's do that.
All right, so we'll start the scene.
So you're going to cue the music, right?
Can I point at you, and it'll come on? All right, let's try that. So.
Yes, it's quite possible. If he knew and were certain that the show would fail, a man could make a fortune.
Yes?
Yes, what?
Yes, what you were saying. Keep talking.
What was I saying?
You were saying that under the right circumstances, a producer could make more money with a flop than he could with a hit.
Yes, it's quite possible.
You keep saying that, but you don't say how.
Well, it's simply a matter of creative accounting.
Uh-huh.
Let's assume for a moment that you're a dishonest man.
Assume away.
All right. When you produced your last show, Funny Boy, you raised $2,000 more than you needed. But you could have raised $1,000,000, put on your $100,000 flop, and kept the rest.
But what if my show was a hit?
Well, then you would go to jail. See, rather than 100% of the show, you would have sold more than 1,000%. And so if the show's a success, there's no way to pay off the backers. Get it?
Got it. So in order for our scheme to work, we'd have to find a surefire flop.
Our scheme? What scheme?
What scheme? Your scheme, you bloody little genius!
I meant no scheme. I merely posed a little academic accounting theory. It was just a thought.
Bloom, worlds are turned on such thoughts. Don't you see, Bloom? Darling Bloom, glorious Bloom, it's so simple. Step one, we find the worst play ever written. Step two, we hire the worst director in town. Step three, I raise $2 million.
Two?
Yes, one for me, one for you. There's a lot of little old ladies out there. Step four, we hire the worst actors in New York and open on Broadway. And before you can say step five, we close on Broadway, take our $2 million, and go to Rio.
Rio? No, that would never work.
Oh, ye of little faith. What did Lewis say to Clark when everything looked bleak? What did Sir Edmund say to Tenzing as they struggled towards Everest Peak? What did Washington say to his troops as they crossed the Delaware? I'm sure you're well aware.
What'd they say?
We can do it. We can do it. We can do it, me and you. We can do it. We can do it. We can make our dreams come true. Everything you've ever wanted is just waiting to be had. Beautiful girls wearing nothing but pearls, caressing you, undressing you, and driving you mad. We can do it. We can do it. This is not the time to shirk. We can do it. You won't rue it. Say goodbye to petty clerk. Hi, producer. Yes, producer. I mean you, sir. Go berserk. We can do it. We can do it. And I know it's gonna work. What do you say, Bloom?
What do I say? Finally a chance to be a Broadway producer. What do I say? Finally a chance to make my dreams come true, sir. What do I say? What do I say? Here's what I say to you, sir. I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. That's not me. I'm a loser. I'm a coward. I'm a chicken, don't you see? When it comes to wooing women, there's a few things that I lack. Beautiful girls wearing nothing but pearls, chasing me, embracing me, I'd have an attack.
Why, you miserable, cowardly, wretched little caterpillar, don't you ever want to become a butterfly? Don't you want to spread your wings and flap your way to glory?
No!
We can do it. We can do it. We can grab that holy grail. We can do it. We can do it.
I'm not a
crook.
I'm just a schnook.
Not
the bottom line is that I stink.
Come on, Leo.
Can't
you see O?
When you see Rio, I see J.
We can do it.
I can't do it.
We can do it.
I cannot do it, cause I know it's gonna fail.
Fail? How can it miss? All you need is a little courage. Bloom, you're like a fountain waiting to explode and shoot into the sky.
I'm a fountain?
Yes, you're a fountain!
Okay, well, that's fun. Matt Locke, Sumsteg, and Jeff Cote in a few moments there from The Producers, which runs June 15th through July 15th at 6th Street Playhouse. That's exciting, guys.
I know.
I love that counterpoint in there at the end where you two are singing together.
Oh, yeah. No, definitely. There's some beautifully written music in there.
Counterpoint, you know, music counterpoint, but counterpoint of the lines. Mm-hmm. Because, Matlock, you're holding your role, and Jeff, you're holding your role, and you know you're playing off against each other, and it's all in music. What a cool
it's so much
thing!
Fun.
It is. It's a lot of fun.
There's another point right at the end of the first act. The entire company comes out and sings this amazing counterpoint finale that really wraps up everything that we've seen come to fruition.
Right, almost every scene comes in as its own, with its own song in a way, and it all blends together beautifully.
It's amazing.
It's just amazing.
And that's the part of the brilliance, is that we really start the show with this kind of contrast and this kind of energy, and then the show just keeps layering on character after character. So we've got some great performances from Mark Bradbury as Franz Liebkin.
Right, and Larry Williams does a great job as Roger. He's an improviser with Sixth Street Improv, and he's just on point. He's excellent.
And, of course, April Krautner, who's been one of the most recognizable comedians of our stage this last season. She's playing Ula.
And of course, Adam Buchholder is playing the fantastic Carmen Ghia.
common law assistant to Roger Dupree.
Fantastic. We're talking about The Producers. It runs June 15th through July 15th at 6th Street Playhouse. You can get more information at 6thstreetplayhouse.com. We are going to have a pair of tickets to give away in just a moment. But not before I thank our guests for their performance today and for squeezing the band into this tiny studio.
You guys are
still packing up.
Okay. And the musicians union was just having a fit. Conditions here are not right. So let's give those tickets away. We're going to take caller number 4 to 584-2020, 584-2020. Caller number 4 gets that pair of tickets. Your choice of performance to The Producers at 6th Street Playhouse. It runs from June 15th through July 15th. For more information, go to 6thstreetplayhouse.com. My guests are Matlock Zumsteg, Jeff Cote, and Craig Miller. I want to thank you all for being my guests. And
thank you.
Have a great run.
All right.
Thanks so
Charles.
Much, Charles.
Thanks
thank
a
you.
Lot, Charles.
Producers at 6th Street Playhouse. Running from June 15th through July 15th. If you want more information, go to 6thstreetplayhouse.com. It's all letters except the first character, which is the Arabic 6. I'm Charles Sipos. It's Curtain Call on KRCB Santa Rosa. And with me is composer Hugh Livingston, who's here to talk about his work and preview his show, Sonoma Oaks, Points of View, opening Saturday evening at Sonoma County Museum. And Hugh, I characterized you as an environmental composer. I don't know if that's accurate. What would you call yourself?
That's fine. My music is heard in the environment. Sometimes natural environments, sometimes artificial environments.
It's not what we usually think of in terms of music. It seems to me like a view. Like it's looking at music as if as.
I like the term soundscape.
Soundscape, yeah, indeed.
That follows from landscape.
I'm trying to draw a parallel here, though, to the art world, because it seems to me that you are approaching music as a contemporary artist approaches art.
I think that's a fair description. I think I have two ways in which I approach the intersection of ecology or environmental sources and conventional music or sound making by humans. And the first is as a kind of overlay. For a long time, I thought, oh, well, music has this connection to nature, and we should look at imitating bird song and various things as a way to make something new that maybe hasn't been made before. And then I decided that was completely wrong. And I let the birds do their singing, if we can use a human word to describe what they do, and which is communication. And let me think of a way to make a soundscape that layers on top of that fits in somehow, that is a complement to it, that makes you listen a little more closely.
Okay, so let's get an idea of what you do by listening to an example of your work.
Great.
So you want to start with the first track?
Yes.
That you brought?
Yes.
Okay, do you want to set this up for us? Let us know what we're hearing here.
I think I'll just say very quickly that it's an extension of harmonies from Debussy, who wanted to have his music heard outdoors, apparently, and so in a way I'm releasing it into the wild. The harmonies are from Nuage, and I have computer software which extends them indefinitely, so the progression can unfold over 5 minutes or 52 days if you choose.
This is not 52 days.
Yes.
This
is a couple minutes.
Yeah, okay.
And it's overlaid with Sonoma nature sounds, some owls at night.
Thank you.
music by Hugh Livingston, who's my guest this segment. I'm Curtin Call. Soundscape. Yeah. It. One thing I noticed is that the nature sounds recast the musical sounds, and the musical sounds recast the nature sounds. It's not like hearing each one of them separately, because they affect one another and really recast each other.
I think that's true. I mean, it happens that the conventional instrumental playing has a kind of amorphous quality where the time isn't clear, the rhythm isn't clear, and that could be said of birds calling to each other, for example, or wind gusts coming up, or something like that.
So how did you get into this kind of composition, Hugh?
Well, I'm not sure exactly. I could trace a series of progressions from one thing to another, but I came from a career as a cellist. I played since I was 6 years old, and by the time I finished college, I was exclusively devoted to contemporary practice, experimental improvisation, Asian fusion, electroacoustic, and so on. And I got both my master's and PhD in the area of contemporary cello performance practice.
Really?
And then just was exploring a lot of things and decided I could also call myself a composer. And I got a great opportunity to create a permanent sound installation for a Frank Gehry building in Santa Monica. And then as I looked for more ways to create sound in public spaces that didn't require the ritual of a concert hall, I started doing sound environments in gardens, and then I became really devoted to nature recording and to Arising Before Dawn to set up microphones and try to capture that experience.
So what are your tools besides recording equipment?
Well, it's a lot of time in the field with special microphones, and it's a lot of time then editing afterwards and trying to see what
on a computer
emerges. But yes, on a computer. And then
when you say special mics, do you mean shotgun mics that pick up long distances?
Not necessarily. I use a parabolic reflector for some of my work, but there's a guy in Sweden who makes microphones under the name Tilinga. And they're super low noise, which is great for nature recording, because you want lots of space for just the soft things to come through.
Yeah.
And so binaural setup, which I wrap around a tree so it simulates the way humans hear.
Really?
And so that's sort of the basis of that.
Ah, fascinating. So, but you're mixing into many channels. I think this current installation that's going into Sonoma County Museum is 6 channels, if I'm not mistaken.
It is. And out in the garden, there's a wonderful new sculpture garden, if people haven't been to the museum recently. And I have an 18-channel sound environment that permanently plays in that garden.
I've seen some of your installations where they're up to 24 channels, and you could possibly even do more, right?
I think 58 is my current record. So, yeah, I write computer software in a platform called Max MSP, which enables a kind of improvisation with coded rules. So I say, let's set up I call them engines that generates bird sound every once in a while. It has a random number generator, chooses a random bird file, chooses a random delay.
So you're dealing with samples that you gathered yourself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have another example here. Is this a good time to listen to that?
Quickly, I want to touch on what you started with, which was the idea that my approach may relate to contemporary art practice. And so I would say, parallel to the kind of artwork I demonstrated earlier, I'm also interested in a conceptual practice which delves into video as well as sound and installation and visual kinds of things. I work a lot with color. And that is the idea of extracting some element of nature. It's the idea of the museumification, if I can say that, of the nature and natural environment. Do we spend more time at a natural history museum than we spend actually outside looking at things? So some of my work, including the video pieces that I've prepared for this gallery show that's opening at the Sonoma County Museum, delve into extraction of one single thing. So I have time-lapse videos. I have some high frame rate. They're shot at 400 or 1,200 frames a second of a single drop of water hitting a single oak leaf.
Oh.
And, like, what is that extracted from the wild?
Mm.
And put in a museum, because I can't really give you the sense of being outside.
Yeah, there's an element of timelessness here. I mean, even though time is an element in what you do, I think the effect is timelessness on the listener, like taking the listener or the viewer out of time.
I think that's a great observation. That's how I feel about it.
Yeah. So should we listen to this now?
Yeah, sure. This is a little conceptual thing which highlights the museum aspect, I think, and it's obviously meant to be humorous, and all I can say is in 1 minute and 47 seconds there are over 600 edits.
Black-throated sparrow. Northern cardinal. Black-chinned sparrow. Chipping sparrow. Song sparrow. Swamp sparrow. American tree sparrow. Rufous crowned sparrow.
Hugh Livingston brought us a sample of his art, and it's very different. You know, it's very different from just thinking about composition, yet there are all those elements of composition there. It's different than experiencing birdsong in nature. It's different than experiencing kalimba at, say, a ceremony in Africa. But there are all those elements that are drawn in, and you use visual elements as well in your work.
Yes. So I guess you bring up an issue. Is it possible that in 1 second, in one quick glance, you could understand the whole without listening for hours, that you could get something from it, from one little snapshot? It's obviously easier with visual things, but can I make the equivalent, a snapshot with sound, where you get in 1 second? I think from the visual side, I have a high frame rate video I've made of oak leaves shimmering in the wind, and that pairs. It's a triptych. So there's the water droplets, and then there's a little gust of wind ruffling, and then there's shadows.
Now, when you say high frame rate, that means that when you play it back, that it's slow motion?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So typical is 24 or 30 frames a second. If I'm shooting at 400, I can play it back 13.3 times slower and have it look like beautifully seamless. And so you just, it's very sensual kind of work.
Amazing.
And I think, I just was to say quickly, and the shadows, you will know from a mile away that those are the shadows of oak trees. I think people live in Sonoma will identify with that instantly.
The exhibit is called Sonoma Oaks, Points of View, and it opens tomorrow night at Sonoma County Museum. For more information, you can go to sonomacountymuseum.org. I understand congratulations are in order. I just saw that you were awarded Composer in Residence, Artist in Residence by American Composers Forum.
Yes, the McKnight Foundation brings two composers from outside Minnesota for two-month residencies there. And I'll be working with Capone Art Park on one of my outdoor operas, I call them. So, and I also have funding from Doris Duke Foundation for next year for a Russian River opera. And that will take place in Healdsburg, actually on the river.
Well, come back to Curtain Call, and we'll talk about it when
pleased to do that.
When it opens. Hugh Livingston is a composer of soundscapes, and his latest show, Sonoma Oaks Points of View, opens Saturday evening at Sonoma County Museum. For more information, go to sonomacountymuseum.org. I have a pair of tickets for the opening tomorrow night. And we'll take caller number 3 to 584-2020.
Or my performance of cello in the gallery on July 1st. People can choose.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. That I didn't know. This is the first time I've heard that. So in any case, your choice of those two possibilities, but we will take caller number 3 to 584-2020, 584-2020. My next guest is Michelle Rosewoman, and let's listen to her wonderful jazz keyboard rendition right now. Michelle Rosewoman, and it's from a CD called Guardians of the Light. Nope. Is that right? Guardians of the Light. And it was called Ask Me Now. Michelle Rosewoman is with me here in studio, and I want to welcome her.
Thank you.
Great to have you. You're performing tonight?
Tonight.
For Healdsburg Jazz Festival, which is in full swing. It runs through June 10th in venues all around Healdsburg. This is the 14th annual Healdsburg Jazz Festival. And let me send our listeners to the website as we speak, healdsburgjazzfestival.org, and you can see what we're talking about as we're speaking. Well, you are a pianist and a composer, and you've been doing this for a while, because I had an earlier CD here from nearly 20 years ago.
Yeah. That just means I have some history and perhaps a little depth and seasoning, which, you know, in this kind of music, you really need that. You got a lot of young players of jazz these days, but it's the living, the music part that really this music is about. So maybe I got a little claim to it now, you know.
There's some wonderful history in this Healdsburg Jazz Festival. And I'll tell you, some people have much longer histories. They probably have more history than your whole lifetime.
That's for sure.
You know, it's just like Roy Haynes.
Well, I'm probably older than you think, but Roy is the essence of the epitome of longevity in the music, and such a blessing to have him. And I actually have a couple of older generation monster musicians with incredible history in the group. Billy Hart and Julian Priest are incredible pieces of history, and either one of their stories could just go for hours. I mean, it's on the way here, I got to hear a lot of Julian's story that I had never heard. So, there's a lot of history in this music and in the players of it.
Do you want to share some of that history?
Oh, well, I wouldn't share other people's personal history, but my own, I can be free with that. Well, just that I'm from Oakland, and my breeding grounds were, for musically speaking, were around Laney Junior College, where I met my mentor, the great Ed Kelly,
really?
Who became a lifelong friend, and I had the blessing of playing duo pianos with him at Yoshi's, as a matter of fact, through the Jazz in Flight production, which Jessica was the heart of many, many, many years ago. So Ed Kelly was a great influence on me and always will be very, very important to me. And the Keystone Corner was where I heard all the greats, and that were all seemed to be coming from New York, which led to my move to New York. I was encouraged by many to come. I was neighbors with the great trumpeter composer from St. Louis, from the Black Artist Group, by Kita Carroll, and through him I met Oliver Lake, Julius Hemphill, and the AACM people, the more avant and contemporary side of the music. But I really came up with the tradition, and so that's just the roots of it. And then the move to New York, you know, one thing led to the next, and I'm also deeply immersed in Cuban folkloric traditions of music.
Oh, yeah.
So I have a group called New Yoruba, which really has a 30-year history already, and we'll be playing a track from my last quintessence recording, which is my longest standing ensemble. So those are my working groups, and I've worked trio quite a bit, and I end up here with in a trio context with Billy Hart, which is a great honor, and the wonderful bass player Andy McKee,
yeah,
who's also a very interesting composer. Tonight we'll be doing a piece of his, a number of mine, and a Julian Priester originals as well.
Mm. So when you get together with folks like this, what do you do in preparation for doing the gig?
Well, lots of practicing and conceiving the music for the particular players and context and setting. You know, it's a lot involved. In fact, even for tonight, I have a lot to do to just sort of think of the pacing of the ensemble. We rehearsed as a trio in New York because we all live on that side. And we rehearsed here yesterday with Julian, our one rehearsal with Julian, who came down from Seattle. So there's so much that goes into the preparation.
Well, I asked that question especially because we think of jazz as so improvisatory, and as improvisatory as spontaneous as it might be, there's a lot behind that.
Well, just
that has to be behind it, or else you don't have the freedom to.
It's a good way
improvise.
To put it. Actually, to play this music, you need more musical knowledge than you need to play other music, because you have all the choices all the time. So you have to know what's right to choose. So not all notes work with all chords. It's a very sophisticated language, very, very sophisticated. And the point is, it's made sophisticated by removing the obvious. We get off of the downbeat and we play the upbeats, just in speaking in a broad sense. We get off the roots in our chords and we play the second or a color tone or an altered tone, anything but the roots. So we obscure things on purpose, which means you have to know the basis in order to step away from it. And as you say, the freedom, with that freedom comes a lot of responsibility. So our practice regiments are very vigorous, to get inside of chord changes, to get inside of varying tempos and feels, to combine with other musicians. It's really an amazing world within itself, and it demands a lot of every player.
I have two questions for you. And I'm going to ask both at once, and then you can answer them in the order that you want. When did you know that your instrument was piano? And when did you know that jazz in the big picture was your medium?
Yeah, I can answer both, really. I remember very specific moments when I was six and my parents brought a big upright home. And the way I felt every day when I peeked out my bedroom door and saw that sitting there, it was like Christmas every day. I just had a feeling, and it drew me, and I just messed around with it for a long time and began a relationship. So that was the beginning. There was a short period where I didn't play from age about 15 to 17, where I kind of running with the faster crowd, and they would tease me when my mother would say she can't talk, come to the phone, she's practicing, so I abandoned it for a couple of years. And really, it was during those couple of years I realized it was my path and a gift of sorts, because my brother, my friends, they had groups, and I would go to their rehearsals and listen, and I'd be thinking, that doesn't work, can't they hear that, why don't they try this? I noticed I had insight. So and then it was a combination of having come up listening to, hearing a lot of jazz classic in my home, and what really capped it was hearing a particular music that I could hear the color and the harmonic depth and whatnot. And then I also read part of a book, I think it was by the writer Martin Williams, a jazz writer at the time, which spoke on the philosophical and social and political aspects of this music. And having come up politically myself and I just, that was it. It all fit, the improvisatory nature, the feeling I had when I heard it, and then its significance socially, politics, it clicked. And then there was also a moment where I heard a Lee Morgan solo from the recording Delightfully Morgan on the track Night Flight. Talk about specific, huh? the one solo I ever transcribed, because a lot of people spend the time transcribing complete solos where I'm trying to kind of develop individual voice, so I didn't do that as much. But that solo I transcribed, and when I heard it, it just made me feel a certain way that I said, that's it. If I can make anybody feel anything like what I feel right now, I know that I'm doing what I'm supposed to do.
Speaking of feeling, are you still, is there still a social and political connection in music for you?
I think definitely. It's maybe a little more subjective now. I mean, one of the things is that in this music seems like a real microcosm of the big picture, because we of really what one should strive for balance and alignment in their life, because you have to both receive, reflect, you have to have a balance of going for it and sitting back to get it. You have to listen very well. You have to respond. You have to, there's so many things that to play this music you have to do that are just the elements of character that we need to develop to be maybe the best person we can be. So I just see it as, I see it in that regard. It's also a great structure for society. If people had that kind of give and take and communication that we have to play this music, you wouldn't have war, you wouldn't have racism, you wouldn't have, I just think it goes on forever. So I still relate very strongly to it as my choice, or that which chose me in my life for all the same reasons. And I do know that it's what I'm personally meant to do.
Mm. What inspires you?
I think I'm very spiritually oriented, and so that's a big part of things. Art, color. My mother was a wonderful artist, and her sense of color and light. I think visual and audio things I'm very receptive to. I'm inspired by humanity, warmth between people. I'm inspired by just the moment-to-moment magic of life when you're kind of tuned in to what you're supposed to be doing. It always takes you where you're supposed to go.
Is there anything that ever just drives you to the piano where you just, you can't do anything else except just go to the piano?
I like your questions. They're nice. Different kind of interview, and I like it. Thank you. Sometimes I have ideas in mind, but see, the piano sits in the center of my apartment, so all I have to do is see it to be drawn to it, and or to know that I better get to it, because sometimes you got to push yourself. But the music's always calling me.
Well, if the music calls you, Michelle Rosewoman is playing with her trio tonight for Healdsburg Jazz Festival. And I'm just looking for the venue. Do you have the venue there?
It's the Raven Theater.
Thank you.
Address, I don't know.
Raven Theater. And you can just look that up. I'll send you to the website for Healdsburg Jazz Festival. It's healdsburgjazzfestival.org. We're going to go out listening to Michelle Rosewoman.
I'd like to say a word about what that is, if you want me to.
Very
also,
quickly.
I just want to say to Jessica Felix, what a great, this, I've been knowing her a long time, but the festival is just a fantastic thing that she does in bringing the town together and bringing musicians together. And we, I just want to give her props for what she does moment to moment. She's probably on four telephones at one time right now.
Always.
The last I saw her. But this is from my last Quintessence release. It features Miguel Zinon, Mark Shim, Brad Jones, Derek Phillips, and a guest trombonist, Josh Roseman. And we have Julian Priester with us tonight on trombone. So he'll hear a track here with trombone in it. With you in mind for Duke Ellington.
Michelle Rosewoman performs tonight at the Raven Theater. I have a pair of tickets. We'll give them away to caller number 5 to 584-2020, 584-2020. That's caller number 5 to 584-2020. I'm Charles Sipos. It's Curtain Call on KRCB Santa Rosa.
Charles Sipos is a composer and teacher of piano, composition, theory, and music appreciation throughout the North Bay. Information at his website, transcend.com, TRANSCENDE.com.